The Athletic.
Let's talk about six, baby. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that may be. Let's talk about six.
In by Tsimikas, shot! Takes a bow in front of a buoyant cop. Lovely take from Elliot. Moved on for Alexander-Arnold. Now Sadio Mane!
So a full house at Anfield and the Reds restoring some normality against Burnley. The Liverpool players reunited with the fans. And of course, that welcome home saw Burnley sunk 2-0. We're going to reflect on that. Harvey Elliott, Jordan Henderson, Van Dijk. So many great talking points. And of course, in a week's time, the transfer window shuts. Do Liverpool need any more additions in the squad? Well, we've got our own Van Dijk and Matip to discuss things today in James Pearce. And our special guest, Ollie Kay. Welcome along, James and Ollie. Hello, guys. Fans reunited shoulder to shoulder with each other inside Anfield. The difference, James, is just palpable, isn't it?
Yeah, it was a great day. I think, usually you associate lunchtime kickoffs in the Premier League with being quite subdued atmosphere-wise, but that was anything but, wasn't it? From the moment the players emerged from the tunnel, followed by Klopp for the warm-up, there was just a real buzz and excitement around the place. And I think you can see how much that lifted the players during the 90 minutes that followed. It was a tough one. I think it always is tough, isn't it, against Burnley? Of course, they'd ended the long home unbeaten run. Was it 68 games back in January? You know, they're always a handful. And you could tell that Klopp wasn't particularly impressed on the touchline with some of the physicality that Liverpool had to contend with. But, to their credit, they refused to be bullied. And when they did have little tough periods in the game, you know, that support from the fans and the soundtrack really, really lifted them. And in the end, it was, a pretty emphatic victory.
I think what set the tone for me of the day, and just to go ahead of the football first, obviously the fans inside Anfield, but hugely emotional when Peter McDowell, who's, on the microphone pitch side, played tribute, Ollie, to the players we've lost, Ian St. John, Ray Clemens, Gerard Houllier, staff members, fans, and then obviously the cop held the mosaic of 97. That sort of set the template for everything for me. I think a lot of people had a tear in their eye.
Yeah, it was very emotional, very, very emotional. I saw, there was the game, I can't remember, was it against Wolves or Leicester back in December, which was just after Gerard Houllier died, and there was obviously the tribute then, and there were a few fans inside the ground for that game. But it's felt, I mean, it's been so long since there've been fans back inside the ground, and we've seen this at various other grounds as well. Tributes being paid to all the people, all the people, whether it's players, staff, supporters, ex-managers who have been lost in the period, and it's a terrible number, really. Real legends in the case of Liverpool, and hugely valued staff members, long-serving supporters who love the club, and of course Andrew Devine, which was such a sad case, and obviously the 97th Hillsborough victim, and that was a recurring theme from the fans throughout the game. Justice for the 97. It wasn't 96. Just now, justice for 97, and the mosaic, I think, was a lovely touch. But Liverpool. I think all clubs do, but Liverpool, it's always been this special thing about paying tribute to those who have been lost. And it certainly added to the atmosphere.
Yeah, I just think as a club, they're absolutely brilliant at that. So whoever is involved, well done. It was poignant indeed. Let's talk about the performance. James, it wasn't a performance that sent out warning signs to others, but actually, at this stage of the Premier League, that's not the worst thing, is it? Sometimes, you don't want those massive occasions too soon. Liverpool just getting on with it. Two wins now, back to back.
Yeah, two wins, two clean sheets. And yeah, I thought, very rarely do you see a game against Burnley that anyone plays where it's a really polished, completely accomplished performance, just because I think Burnley just don't let you play like that. They are a handful. they are different to most other challenges you come up against. And a big thing was, you know, matching them physically. I thought Van Dijk, you know, but considering that, you know, that was a real step up for him in his rehab to handle, you know, Barnes and Wood and, you know, and the, all the high balls that came with. And, you know, he won battle after battle. And I thought Matip as well was exceptional. You know, they've certainly repaid Klopp's faith in terms of deciding to start the season with those two as the defensive axis rather than throwing in Konate or Gomez. Both fullbacks, I thought, you know, obviously both created a goal. Simikas built on where he left off at Carrow Road with, you know, has shown that he is now, you know, a genuine quality backup for Robertson. And on the other flank, you know, more signs that Trent massively benefited from the break that he didn't want, but the break that he got in the summer with missing the Euros. And then, you know, even the midfield, I think probably, you know, it was a, again, similar to the game at Norwich, it was a very unfamiliar looking midfield with, you know, Milner had a calf problem. Oxlade-Chamberlain was at the birth of his child. Of course, Fabinho's on compassionate leave after losing his dad. So, you know, Naby Keita had Henderson obviously back in the team, and, you know, a real brave, bold decision, I thought, from Klopp to give Harvey Elliott his full Premier League debut. But, you know, he certainly grasped that chance with both hands.
Yeah, let's dive into Harvey Elliott, because he's young and they always say don't put pressure on youngsters' shoulders, but you can't help but get excited about this lad. And Jürgen's never been afraid, Ollie, to throw young players in if he's absolutely confident about them, give them big opportunities. His pre-season form suggested this was always going to be likely.
Yeah, and his form at Blackburn on loan last season, and to be honest, even going further back, his pre-season form in the past, because I think from the moment he was 16 when he turned up on in that first pre-season, you know, when they were in Evian, that's 2 years ago, and apparently he made a huge impact on the team, on the players and the coaching staff then. Played, you know, a handful of appearances that season. Then another good season, pre-season, went on loan to Blackburn. Well, one thing people always say when a young player goes on loan at that age, at a top club, you need them not just to get minutes, you need them to stand out in a way that would make you think, if he wasn't your loan player, God, that lad's good, that lad's performing well at that level, because you need to be at 17, 18. It's no good just going on loan and making appearances but drifting out of the team. He did really, really well at Blackburn last season. And, you know, I know James has written about him and Keith has written about him. And the way he performed at Blackburn was really, really good. He was one of the best young players in the Championship last season. And the way he, I've not seen the preseason games, but everybody spoke about the preseason performances being so, so good. And yet it's still a massive step up to play, start a game in the Premier League and against Burnley, who really do make it difficult for you. Obviously, you're going to get probably more of the ball against Burnley than you would against a lot of teams, but physically they are very, very, they're very, very demanding, very, very tough team to play against.
Well, they roughed him up, didn't they? I mean, early on, Josh Brownhill flattened him within 5 minutes.
Yeah, and McNeil as well, I think, in the early stages. It did feel as if they were saying, yeah, let's let him know we're there. Let's see what he's made of. And the fact that he seemed to grow into the game, he was better in the second half, I think, than the first. It was obviously a beautiful pass for Mo Salah for the disallowed goal. Which was brilliant vision, brilliantly executed. But I thought his second half performance was really, really good. He just wanted the ball and was so confident on the ball. I think it's a really, really good sign.
I mean, if you could say anything, James, and he was superb, but it was almost like he was trying too hard, just trying to grasp that moment. And you can understand why. Am I right in saying that he's been working right over the summer on his physicality, actually came back lighter, came back in great shape? So he's not left Blackburn and thought, well, I'll have a bit of a rest.
I mean, he could have had 6 weeks holiday. That was essentially the break between the end of his commitments with Blackburn and needing to report back to Kirby for pre-season. But he only had a fortnight. He took a fortnight to rest, didn't didn't leave the country, and then was straight back in the gym out running, because I think, you know, he was on a mission to come back in pre-season and quickly dispel any talk that he'd need to go out on loan again. Because I think that, you know, that was a talking point at the start of pre-season. And I think that probably within days rather than weeks of pre-season, I think that decision was made because of just how big an impression he made on Klopp and Pep Linders and Peter Crouch on the training field. And that's a massive credit to him. You know, Pep Linders came out with a quote in pre-season, which I think kind of epitomises Harvey Elliott. He said, with our young players, we look for someone who's got the kind of confidence in themselves to nutmeg Virgil van Dijk on the training pitch. But when they see him in the corridor of the hotel, step aside for him. And I think that is Harvey Elliott. You can see that, you know, he's fearless, isn't he? Like, as you said before, Burnley did try and rough him up. I think a lot of young players would have gone missing having had like an introduction to the game like that. And I also thought, I thought he did look a little bit nervous early on. There was a couple of misplaced passes. But I think it says a lot about his temperament and his attitude and his personality. The fact that rather than hiding, he kept on demanding the ball. He kept on wanting to try and make things happen. As Ollie said, he was very unfortunate not to get an assist with the Mo Salah disallowed goal by VAR, and then was heavily involved in that second goal with the pass to Trent Alexander-Arnold, who set up Sadio Mane. So, it's been a real challenge for him this summer, having to learn a new position, because essentially, you know, he is a right-sided winger. But I think there was this feeling, well, you know, how can we make the best of Harvey Elliott? Because, of course, Mohamed Salah, that is his position. You know, he's not going anywhere. So it's about, you know, like how can we tap into that ability and still find room for it in the team? And, you know, he's shown, like, tactically and attitude and temperament-wise that he can be versatile.
Yeah, of course, because he was playing Mo's position at Blackburn, supporting Adam Armstrong, who scored a hatful of goals. The thing with getting a chance in this Liverpool side, Ollie, is you have to take that opportunity. You know, you really have to grasp it. And he did just that.
Yeah, you look at Curtis Jones, who made, I mean, it was his debut, was it that FA Cup tie against Wolves a couple of seasons back? And he was sort of thrown in and didn't really grasp the opportunity that night. And it took a long time for the opportunity to come again, really. It was the, you know, the League Cup games at the start of the following season. So it's you have to hit the ground running. You can't just be a, you know, a sort of 11th man, a passenger in the team. You have to be a really significant, you have to make a really significant contribution to the team. And Harvey Elliott did that yesterday. I mean, he did look, the first half, first 20 minutes or so, he did look nervous. He did look like he was a little bit knocked out of his stride by some of the Burnley challenges. And I was thinking, well, this could be awkward if they end up sort of having to take him off at half time. You know, that happened to Nico Williams last season, didn't it? You know, where he started the old game and didn't really take it or didn't look like he was ready to sort of step up and be a confident member of the team. But Harvey Elliott did, you know, he did look nervous initially, but he did really grow into the game. And you can tell the quality he has, and you can tell that he's going to be a regular member of the match day squad this season. I'd just be interested, you know, by your thoughts about how many games you could see him starting in the Premier League this season. Because he's, you know, it's one thing to say, look, he's shown himself to be an option for starting games, but it would still be a big, big leap, really, in terms of experience if he was to start, say, even half the Premier League games. It would be, that to me would be quite unexpected. But you could see him starting 5-10 Premier League games and making really regular contributions from the bench.
What do you think, Chet? I mean, for me, it wouldn't be a surprise if he was starting some of the big games. So I don't think there's a Liverpool fan who, if you saw his name on a team sheet against a Man City, a Man United, would be too concerned about that. That says a lot.
Yeah, I think it's difficult to try and predict at the moment how much we will see of him. I think because, you know, we rewind a week, I don't think anyone would have expected him to be in there from the start against Burnley. And of course, as well as he has done on the training field, which is where Klopp judges everything, it was also circumstances, you know, that presented that opportunity with, of course, you know, Milner's injury and Oxlade-Chamberlain, you know, at the birth of his child. And so, you know, and obviously Fabinho being away. So it is, Klopp, probably a lot of people rolled their eyes, didn't they, in pre-season when Klopp described Harvey Elliott as a new midfielder, because everyone was, there was a clamour for Liverpool to go and spend big and buy, a ready-made Gini Wijnaldum replacement. I still think it requires a leap of faith to believe that Liverpool have got enough in that department. I think they have numbers-wise, because I think it was eight midfielders if you count Harvey Elliott. I think my only concern is that it feels like you're relying quite a lot on Keita and Oxlade-Chamberlain to stay fit, and for James Milner to continue kind of defying Father Time. So, I think trust is such a big thing, isn't it, for a young player and a manager, and there's no doubt that Harvey Elliott has got Klopp's trust. I still think when everyone's fit and available, we'll be seeing a lot of Fabinho, Thiago and Henderson, because that was a trio that never really got the chance to play much together last season.
So are you saying that he does provide the solution in terms of not going out in this transfer window? Or are you still a little bit
I think the jury's still out. I don't think, I think Klopp was very kind of defiant and bullish when I asked about it recently, about why he hadn't gone and bought a Wijnaldum replacement and rattled off all the options that he's got. And, and suddenly when you see Harvey Elliott perform like that, and I think he can give that midfield a new creative dimension, because traditionally Klopp's midfield has been more about being workmanlike and having tactical discipline and control. And, there hasn't been a huge amount of goals and assists from midfield. So I think the signs are promising there, as the signs are promising from Naby Keita. I mean, every season we have the same conversation about Naby Keita, don't we? This season's make or break. It's now or never for him at Liverpool. And again, you'd have to say Naby Keita started the season really brightly. And if Naby Keita can continue along the same vein and stay fit, and if Harvey Elliott continues to develop like he can, then I think Klopp could well be proved right in terms of not needing a Wijnaldum replacement. But at the moment it's too soon to say, because, the caveat has to be it's only been Norwich, it's only been Burnley, and there are much tougher tests to come.
Transfer window shuts, Ollie, August the 31st at 11 p.m. Are you reassured there's enough in that midfield for Liverpool to have the challenge that they desire?
Well, I can tell James is a little bit unsure, sort of waiting to be convinced. I think I would put myself in that category as well. I mean, as James says, the fitness of Oxlade-Chamberlain and Keita and their ability to avoid injury. I mean, Henderson's picked up quite a few injuries over the last couple of seasons as well, and it's we're talking about every one of those players really having to play a lot more games than they've played over the last two or three years. I mean, Henderson would probably have to play more than he played in the past. Thiago's not somebody who's generally played 50, 60 games a season in the past either. So I think I would be more convinced if you reel off the names that we've all mentioned, it's a deep midfield department. There's qualities, different kinds of players, there's depth, but it's just that suspicion really that is Keita going to be able to play 40 games? Is Oxlade-Chamberlain going to be able to play 40 games? Is Henderson going to be able to play 50 games? Is Thiago going to be able to play 50 games? Wijnaldum, you always looked at him and thought, yeah, he's not going to get injured. He's going to be able to adapt to different roles, and he's going to be there week in and week out. That's what I worry about. I don't worry so much about the quality. I would just say the depth. When you look at the depth, it's great when everybody's fit. But when one person's missing, or when two players are missing, that puts more physical demands on everybody else, and it increases the likelihood of a Milner or Anderson or somebody else picking up an injury if they're playing too many games. So yeah, I would be a bit unsure about that. I think most people would be more convinced if another midfielder came in, but not just somebody to make up the numbers, but quality. And it might be that there's not enough money there to get quality options because they've not been able to offload players that they've wanted to. And I would say the same about the forward line as well. Brilliant options. But is there enough depth if Mo Salah picks up an injury? Because if Mo Salah picks up an injury, probably the guy who would step in for him will end up being Harvey Elliott on the right. So does that then leave them a midfielder light? So I think if you compare to the squad depth that Chelsea and Manchester City have, and even Manchester United to an extent, they've all got deeper squads, I would say. But I think the quality that Liverpool have, if they can keep everybody fit, is definitely good enough.
James, are there still some question marks over a couple of players as to whether they stay? I know we've talked in recent Red Agendas on Divock Origi and Jerdan Shaqiri and their futures, and probably suspected that they might have moved on in this window, but it's gone quiet. We've got a week left.
Yeah, oh, there's certainly big question marks about their futures. I think it just shows, you know, what a difficult transfer market it's been, especially for those kind of middle of the road kind of deals. Yeah, we've seen some like massive eye-watering figures that, you know, Liverpool's rivals have paid for players, but we haven't seen too many kind of 10, 15 million pound sales done. And that's effectively where, you know, Shaqiri and Origi fit into. And, you know, of course, with Shaqiri, you know, he came out publicly a few weeks back and said he was ready for a new challenge, and Liverpool are certainly open to giving him that. But at the moment, there isn't a suitable offer on the table. So you're in probably the same with Origi as well. You're in that position at the moment where, what do Liverpool do? Do they sit tight right to the end of the window and hope that someone's need is so great that they suddenly offer, you know, a significantly larger sum of money? Because, of course, Lyon were in for Shaqiri, but I think they were only offering 4 million when Liverpool wanted 12. Or do Liverpool have to reduce their own demands and take less? So, yeah, some big decisions still to be made. I mean, Nat Phillips is another one that, you know, for a while now, it's looked pretty certain that Nat Phillips would move on. But then, you know, again, you know, there's been all kinds of inquiries, but no real, you know, suitable firm offers that have come in. Liverpool adamant they don't want to go down the route of loaning him out. You know, that they don't really see the benefit of in that. He's inside the last 2 years of his deal. And, you know, of course, there's a feeling that after how well he did in the second half of last season, this summer, you know, he, the player himself, wants to play regularly, and Liverpool feeling that his value should be massively enhanced by helping them qualify for the Champions League. So, and then, you know, those three players would obviously leave for significant sums of money if the deals can be done. And then you've got, you know, the other end of the spectrum, you're still trying to offload people like Loris Karius and Shea Ojo. So, yeah, I think in terms of any more incomings, I think Shaqiri and Origi would both need to go for Liverpool to then look to bring someone in as an attacker.
But there's no obvious names, nothing strong that you're hearing at the moment, as in an incoming.
No, I know. Yeah. But I think there's just too much up in the air in terms of outgoings at the moment. And you know, certainly with Origi, you know, there's been no noises from his camp that he's looking to kind of agitate for a move or anything like that. And of course, contracts work both ways, don't they? So, you know, you have to respect that. If he ends up saying that he does want to stay and fight for his place.
I suspect, Ollie, that any disappointment from fans on a lack of incomings might be tempered on a new contract for Jordan Henderson being announced. Maybe I've been a little bit, I don't know. But, you know, Jordan, Mo, that these are contracts still to be resolved. And I think it looks positive on Jordan's front. And again, if you saw him play against Burnley, sets the tempo. It's a different side with him in.
Oh, I thought he was excellent yesterday. That midfield, if you look at the other players he was playing with in midfield, it was, you know, Keita and Elliott, and they're guys who are less sort of physically robust than he is. And obviously it could have been difficult against Burnley and the way they kind of go very narrow with their four in midfield and how physical they are. And Henderson just, you know, he made sure there was no real vulnerability in that midfield. Obviously, Fabinho was missing. Henderson played a bit deeper, and it wasn't just sort of, you know, I think a lot of the time with Henderson, we just talk about his leadership, what he brings to the team, what they lack when he's not there. But you saw yesterday, I mean, his passing was excellent. The composure he showed on the ball was excellent. I thought he slotted in really, really well. And I think, you know, because he didn't get, he barely got on the pitch during the Euros in the summer. And, you know, a lot of people who aren't you know, who don't watch Liverpool regularly, I think they kind of think he's just some kind of guy who claps a lot and shouts a lot and doesn't really bring much else. But Liverpool are so much better with him, with Fabinho, with I mean, obviously with Van Dijk, but these are guys who, in stature, but also in quality and the qualities they bring on the ball, the qualities that they show on the pitch, are just so important to the way Liverpool play. And he slotted in brilliantly yesterday.
Is it close, that deal, James? Now is that virtually there?
Yes. Yeah. I don't envisage any other issues with it now that you know, I think a new 3-year contract with the option of a fourth year. You know, I think obviously we reported on The Athletic last week that there'd been a breakthrough in those discussions, and I'd expect Andy Robertson's new deal to get wrapped up pretty shortly as well. You know, again, those talks have gone well. Liverpool looking to tie him down for the long term. So I think clearly those two are heading for a very swift, successful conclusion in the near future. And then it'll be all eyes to see what happens with Mo Salah's situation, because I think that one is probably more complex for Liverpool to get done.
Yeah, you've written a really good piece on this, and I was intrigued by one element of it. So it'd be good to get both your thoughts on this. And this is about wage structure. So who holds the most important hand? You know, Michael Edwards would obviously love to throw the kitchen sink at him, but he can't because it upsets the balance in the dressing room. But then, of course, you've got Mo, who's looking at Jack Grealish and his wage after his £100 million move, and saying, and it's him and his agent, Remy Abbas, will be saying, well, I'm worth X. So how on earth do you resolve this when Liverpool's got such a tight bracket?
Yeah, it's not easy. And I think that is why this one probably will drag on longer than the other ones we've seen this summer, because clearly, Remy Abbas and Mo Salah want the best possible deal. And I'm sure Remy Abbas is pointing to the fact that you only have to look at Salah's numbers. You know, they're absolutely ridiculous, aren't they? And I was in that piece I wrote, I was looking at, based on, I think he's 12th, isn't he, at the moment, in terms of Liverpool's all-time goal scorers, which in itself is absolutely mad when, he's only been at the club 4 years. And he's scoring at a rate that no one above him in those list of all-time goal scorers has ever done before. So you can understand in that context why, Remy Abbas and Salah and his representatives are saying, well, we're talking about one of the, not only is he one of the greatest players in world football at the moment, but he's done it week after week, month after month for a long, long period now. And obviously at this stage in his career, wants a contract extension that reflects that. So, he's certainly not underappreciated by FSG or anything like that. I think they know just how valuable Mo Salah is. It's just that an extension has to be done within the, within the structure that they've got there, because I think there's a feeling that has been key to Liverpool's success. The fact that, that there isn't a massive disparity between what a lot of their elite players earn. And, of course, a lot of the deals as well are heavily incentivized with bonuses. That is why it's a complex exercise. And I think if they can get it done, I think it would be a 2-year extension. So at the moment, he's under contract till 2023. They're keen to extend it to 2025. But I think at the moment you can only go on what you see and the people you speak to. And no one's had a bad word to say about Mo Salah from the day he came back for pre-season in terms of his hunger, his drive, his desire. There's certainly not any whisper at all that his commitment to the club has dwindled. If anything, I think it's intensified. And I think he was frustrated as anyone, the fact that Liverpool didn't compete for the big prizes last season, and he's determined to make sure it's different this time around.
He looks happy, Ollie. He looks focused. Going back to the money issue, how much does it upset the apple cart in a dressing room, do you think? He is an elite player. He probably deserves the highest of the wages. But what sort of balancing act is there here?
It is a balancing act. And I can't see Klopp being somebody who would want there to be a massive disparity in the wage structure either. I think the way Klopp manages, the way he manages people, and it's always been very sort of collective, and at Dortmund as well, they've never had the sort of sense of there being a superstar. You can have stars within a team, but it's always sort of felt very equal. I don't know just how much more Salah might be offered than other people are already earning, but the fact that Van Dijk and Alexander-Arnold and Alisson and Fabinho and soon to be Robertson and Henderson, the fact they've already signed new deals or agreed new deals or close to agreeing new deals means that you're not suddenly going to get a rush of players reacting to a new Salah contract by saying, well, actually, do you know what? I think it's probably clever. I mean, I think fans probably look at it and say, well, why have they waited so long with Salah? You know, why isn't Salah the priority? But it's probably quite clever to get all of those deals agreed first. But yes, Salah's going to be a test because he is one of the best players in the world. He's one of the most marketable players in the world. This will probably be his last big contract. And his agent is probably looking around and thinking, well, other clubs offer more money. Other clubs pay more money. You look at Manchester United at the moment and they're sort of, you know, they already pay Paul Pogba an enormous amount. You know, I think it's more than Salah earns currently. And they're going to break that structure to try to offer him a chance to become the best paid player in the club's history. That's Paul Pogba, who turned up at Manchester United 5 years ago and has been, you know, really inconsistent. Hasn't done anything like what Salah's done at Liverpool. And yet he's going to be offered a chance to earn an absolutely enormous wage if he wants to. He might prefer to see his contract out and go to PSG or wherever in the summer. So it might not be easy to persuade Salah in this market, look, yes, you can earn this at another club, but we want you to earn this lesser salary at Liverpool. I think Salah is somebody who's clearly his commitment to scoring, to playing brilliantly, to, you know, training, getting himself in the best condition. His commitment is not going to waver one bit, but I can also see his agent being rather difficult, shall we say, over this negotiation. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that goes. But I think, as James mentioned in the piece, the usual option that a player of that sort of profile would have of flirting with Real Madrid and flirting with Barcelona, that option doesn't really seem to be there at the moment because of the way the market is and the way the football economy is. So you've got, I think the benchmark really wages wise is in the Premier League, and he will be able to say there are A-list players in the Premier League or even B-list players in the Premier League who earn this. So Salah should be getting this as well. So it's difficult, complicated.
The Athletic is teaming up once again with Prostate Cancer UK to help raise money and fight one of the most deadly diseases for men today. And this time, we're not just talking the talk, we're walking the walk, with four athletic writers putting on their hiking boots and joining Soccer Saturday legend Jeff Stelling on his March for Men this summer. Jeff's marching to save men's lives and completing four marathons in 4 days. Why? Because one in eight men get prostate cancer, one in four if you're black. That's a dad, a granddad, a brother, a mate or a partner. The Athletic will be catching up with Jeff from Newcastle to Sunderland, in Leeds, Liverpool and then again in London to find out more about the challenge and find out why he and hundreds of supporters are raising money to beat prostate cancer. Sponsor Jeff today and help beat prostate cancer by heading to prostatecanceruk.org/Jeff's March. That's prostatecanceruk.org/JEFFSMARCH. Men, we are with you.
You both mentioned that actually the fabric, the parts of the machine are all there for Liverpool. Obviously, these key players tying themselves down to the club. Almost all the parts of the machine, James, that took them to the title a couple of seasons ago.
Yeah, and that, you know, that has been a key part of the strategy from the club this summer is to tie down, you know, who they see as the absolute key personnel from that title-winning team of 19-20 that they still think can go again and bring more big prizes back to Anfield. And you know, it's probably a bit of a hidden cost as well, that, you know, there's obviously so much talk about, every day on social media, you get people saying, well, where's the money? You know, where's all the money going and all the rest of it? And it's like, well, you know, renewing these contracts for key players involves a massive outlay of cash when you look at the profile of the players who have committed their futures to the club. I mean, Klopp said himself recently that, I think he was on the back of Van Dijk signing his deal, said, you know, thank God we don't have to go and try and buy these players now, because, you know, imagine how much these players would cost now, where you think, you know, Alisson, you know, again, you know, was immense.
Good.
You know, you could just see that, I think it takes any possible threat to his goal as a personal affront, isn't it? And he was just desperate to ensure that he got that clean sheet. I mean, you wouldn't swap him for anyone. You wouldn't swap Van Dijk for anyone. You know, Trent Alexander-Arnold was given a contract this summer that puts him right up there with the high wage earners as well, which Liverpool felt was absolutely right, considering, you know, where he's gone from. I think his last deal was signed in January 2019. And so, you know, 2.5 years on, you know, they wanted to reflect that. So I think, as we wrote about relatively recently, there is a kind of an acceptance within the club that they can't renew everyone. You know, this isn't emotion based decisions. This is very much, you know, business sense that dictates they need to get these players tied down, because they can't afford for too many players to grow old together and suddenly have, you know, a very bloated wage bill that, you know, you're paying people that are way past their best, extortionate sums of money. But I think, you know, I don't think anyone would argue that the players that they've tied down and the ones they're looking to tie down currently are ones that you still believe that, you know, their best years are ahead of them.
Yeah, it's a big balancing act, isn't it? Ollie, I know you've got an eye across all the big Premier League clubs, and this week in particular, I'm sure with that transfer deadline approaching, just quickly, are we going to see a Kane move? This is going to be the narrative for the next 7 days, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I first wrote about Kane wanting to leave in April, and the piece we did on The Athletic was Kane wants to leave, but can he? You know, there were all these question marks about whether a deal could actually happen. We knew City were interested. We knew Kane wanted to go, but were Spurs going to sell? And so far, the message all summer from Spurs has been, no, we're not selling. We're absolutely not selling. There have been various pieces written about this is what they would sell for, but Manchester City have gone absolutely nowhere near that. I wonder whether, well, look, there's a week of the transfer window to go. We're going to find out just how much Manchester City want him, because surely they either make an offer that's somewhere getting on for Spurs valuation, or they just walk away. And maybe in that case, they look at others. But I've thought all along it's been no more than 50-50 chance of him going to Manchester City. I would be, right now, as we write this, I would say it's less. But it would need something to change in a big way to swing that from a possible to a probable. And it's clear that Spurs are really digging their heels in, as they're absolutely entitled to do. And Kane's entitled to agitate for a move, and Spurs are entitled to dig their heels in, and Manchester City are actually entitled to make an offer if they really wanted. But they don't seem to be doing that. And they must be basing this on a strategy that if they wait and then make their move, they might, you know, that would be the best chance of getting him. But I don't know. All the moves coming out of Spurs are that they are very resistant to selling. So if they sell, they're going to need to, you know, replace and reinvest that money very quickly. And it's very difficult to do. So I don't know whether we're going to get a Kane move. And if not, it will be interesting to see whether Man City have an alternative lined up, because I know Lukaku was somebody they thought seriously about earlier in the summer as an alternative. Haaland they like, but I don't think there's any chance of them getting him this summer. And yeah, what will they do? It's going to be a fascinating 7 days or so.
This is the Red Agenda, brought to you by The Athletic, Ollie Kay and James Pearce. Let's finish the pod this week to talk about
two men who were part of arguably one of the greatest ever Liverpool midfields. James has written about Ray Kennedy, who's been living with Parkinson's for 35 years. Terry McDermott was alongside him in the side. And of course, one of the great goal scoring midfielders. He's revealed that he's been diagnosed with dementia. And of course, Graeme Souness was a guy who partnered them. But it's so sad in a way to hear their stories, but actually brave as well. Now, I know you've spoken with Ray Kennedy's son, James.
Yeah, very real poignant chat with Dale, Ray's son, who obviously has been there with him every step of the way along what's been a brutally long struggle. When you think that he was first diagnosed with Parkinson's in 1986, at the age of 35, he recently celebrated his 70th birthday. So that's exactly half of his life has been spent fighting this. And Dale was saying even going back before that, there were symptoms that he was battling with that before there was the diagnosis. The fatigue that he used to suffer from, the joints seizing up, mood swings, and initially the family were reluctant, I think, to talk about it, because they didn't want to. They're very private people, and they didn't want to be seen to be trying to, they'd never looked for sympathy or for pity or for financial help. They've obviously been massively grateful at various points when Liverpool supporters, one in particular led by Karl Kopak, did a fantastic fundraising drive that helped Ray massively. I think with Ray turning 70, the family were happy just to give people an update, I think, and let them know that, times are tough. Yes, he has carers around the clock. But, Dale was also pretty positive in saying that, despite all of that, despite all the problems and all the issues that he has health-wise, he said he still has a quality of life and he can still have a laugh and his joke with his dad. And just really sad as well. I was speaking to Jimmy Case, who was obviously Ray's best mate during their glory years together at Liverpool, and just Jimmy talking about how hard it is for him to see his best mate like that, and how for some of the players they find it too difficult, that they prefer to remember Ray the way he was rather than the way that he is now, having to battle such a cruel and debilitating illness. So and it's a timely reminder that we certainly, there's obviously a big focus on the current crop. But as we said earlier on, Liverpool have a very strong tradition of looking after their own and remembering their own, especially ones who gave as much to the cause as Ray Kennedy. And we should never forget them.
Absolutely. Arsenal legend as well. So important to both clubs. And I mentioned as well, Terry McDermott. I was with Terry at the game yesterday. He is full of fight, still full of laughs. He's a great guy. It's sad to hear the diagnosis of dementia, Ollie. At the same time, he's the fighter. He says he'll get on with it. And I don't know whether you've read the piece on the club website, but, brave to come forward with it, but to share it with the fans as well. And what a player Terry McDermott was, arguably scoring one of the greatest ever Liverpool goals, the header in the 7-0 win against Spurs.
Yeah, it's one of those goals that, I think every Liverpool supporter will recognise, but I think it win goal of the season. So a lot of fans from further afield will recognise, will remember that goal as well. But it's one thing that really strikes me is that this was happening. We first heard of players getting dementia, and it was always players from the 60s or players from the 50s, players from the 60s. And as this is going on and on and on, it's players that I remember Ray Kennedy and Terry McDermott playing for Liverpool, just the tail end of their careers. And actually maybe that just tells you how old I am, but it's just striking. I mean, Terry McDermott's 69, Ray Kennedy's 70 and has been living with Parkinson's for half his life. It's, after really, their careers as top level footballers are relatively short. Ray Kennedy was at Liverpool for 8 years. I think won 5 league titles and 3 European Cups. But he's been living with Parkinson's for 35 years. Terry McDermott is 69 and has been diagnosed with dementia. And it's just, I saw something Chris Sutton obviously former Norwich and Blackburn and Celtic forward, and put on Twitter last night in response to the news about Terry McDermott and about Dennis Law as well. And he's saying, we keep hearing people be sort of wishy-washy about whether there's a link between football and dementia and football and Alzheimer's. And, you know, people need to stop pretending there's any doubt about this. It's clear there's doubt about it. And you see all of those great teams from the 60s, and you see, you know, so-and-so's died of dementia, so-and-so's died of dementia, so-and-so's got dementia. And it's so sad. It's so unbelievably sad. It does look completely disproportionate when you look at the statistics versus, you know, the statistics in amongst the general public. It's so many players of that generation, and now it's players who, you know, played through the 70s and were still around in the 80s, and it's terribly sad. And as I say, it's very important for players to come out and speak about this and raise awareness, really, because I think there's still a sort of sense, even within the football industry, it feels like people are saying, oh, well, we can't be sure there's a link. And, you know, I think there clearly is a link.
Yeah, we wish them well, everyone at the Athletic, sort of backing them in their fight. And I would encourage you to read James's piece on Ray Kennedy. Terrific piece, and so, so important. Guys, thank you very much indeed for your company on the Red Agenda. Ollie Kay, James Pearce, that was today's Red Agenda on Thursday or Friday. Check it out. We'll be previewing the next big test that lies ahead for Liverpool. It's Liverpool against Chelsea. We'll see you then.